Welcome. You are listening to a UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Conference podcast. I'm Lisa Pruitt, a center faculty affiliate and the organizer of our November 2014 Poverty in Place Conference. This conference brought together scholars from across the social sciences to present and discuss new work on how space and place inflect various dimensions of poverty. In this presentation, Anne Stevens discusses Scott Allard's work on the geography of poverty in the American safety net. Stevens is the director of the Center for Poverty Research and professor of economics at UC Davis.
Thanks very much. That was a great presentation on a paper that was very really great start to the conference and a paper I really enjoyed reading and I learned several very important things from. So it's a pleasure to be able to discuss this work. I guess I just want to start by just very quickly reiterating some of the major findings. And I think as I read this paper a few nights ago, I was really excited both because it was a great paper and very interesting, but I also think it would be hard to find a better start to this conference because it just covers so many of the issues that were really motivating us here. And so as I read it, I have a few comments for the author, but really a lot of my comments towards the end of my time will be directed towards thinking about what this says about poverty research more broadly. And one thing I thought as I read it is this is a great thing for students who are thinking about research ideas to read because it just sets off so many questions on so many areas of poverty research, and I'll try to point to some of those at the end. So what were the main findings? Very briefly, I won't do them justice, they were very well presented, but you know, there's this issue that there is this increased number of poor in our suburbs, but no clear reductions in urban areas. So it's not the story that, yes, the urban poverty that we've talked about for many decades and that got a lot of attention in the 1980s, it's not the case that we've moved that to the suburbs. We still have lots of poor people in urban areas, but we also are either noticing or there's either a trend or we're finally noticing that there are also lots of poor in suburban areas. And one thing that I think is really important is that the story, especially if you look specifically at the quantitative data presented, the story is actually fairly subtle. And I could easily see, perhaps thinking of my own tribe of economists, you can easily see how quantitative disciplines could miss a lot of the story based on some pretty typical choices we make about data and analysis, and I'll talk a little bit about that, and also a few suggestions on how to maybe clarify some of that subtlety and detail. Second point, really important, is that while the public safety net seems to be keeping pace in a sense as poverty has increased in different geographic areas, the private nonprofit safety net might not be. And there's a question as to whether it's about the trend or the level in those areas, which comes up throughout the paper. But I want to talk about some measurement issues and have one minor suggestion about maybe how to get around that. It's a very difficult issue, as Scott realizes. And then I'll turn to these broader implications for poverty research. So the first question is, well, is urban poverty shifting to the suburbs? And the answer is really, no, it's not that simple. But it is the case that we've got great documentation here that there are many poor living in suburban areas. And the thing that I want to highlight, especially for those who work with a lot of quantitative data, is that the answer varies pretty dramatically based on the unit of geography you look at. And economists often, there's lots of data available at the county level, and we often go and grab that data and run our models, and there's more to the story here. And I think this paper lays that out really, really nicely. And so here's just a summary. If you look at the county level, from 1990 to 2010, there's a slight increase from 14 to 15.5% in the poverty rate in urban areas, and actually a very small decrease in suburban areas. So if you just looked at the left side of this table, you would not walk away thinking, wow, suburban poverty is really growing. If, on the other hand, you look at a whole variety of other measures in the paper, and I'm just going to show one small one here, you get a very different picture. And the interesting thing is that to see this, you really need to go to the tract level data, a much smaller unit of geography. And you know, the tract level is also more of what we think of when we think of neighborhoods. We don't think of a county. Some counties in some parts of the country are huge, and they can be very diverse. And so when you go to the tract level, you do see, well, yes, poverty increased from 1990 to 2010 a bit, the poverty rate, I should say, but by a much bigger percentage in suburban areas. And I think what's really striking in the paper, and Scott made this point, is if you think about the number of poor people, there the differences are even more sort of striking, both in comparing the level of the poor in suburban versus urban areas. There's more parity than you might think, and more growth in suburban areas in those numbers. But also, so both in the level and in the change. The one picky detail that, as an economist, I have to point out, and it's a little hard to know what to do, but there is also a difference between the table two, the county, and the tract level, which Scott mentioned, which is to go to the tract level, we don't have the same complete data. And so you focus on the largest 100 metro areas. And so it would just be nice to know, as he mentioned, what's happening in those smaller metro areas and how much is that contributing versus going. But it's pretty clear when he breaks it out by more detail on the suburban track data that there is something pretty interesting happening and lots of poverty concentrated there. But I think, again, sort of for completeness of documentation of this, any sort of closing of that gap about moving to the different sample would be really helpful to get documented. And this is the type of thing that I think researchers do and will spend a lot of time on, and then will probably end up being a footnote somewhere that you... But I think it's really important to have that as part of the literature. You know, continuing on this just a little bit, this first point is just to emphasize what Scott did, which is when you look at the number of poor, you do see this sort of remarkable change over time, and these fractions are there. You see it both at the county level and at the tract level, but it's much more dramatic in the tract level, where if you ask what is the percent increase in the number of poor in suburban versus urban areas, at the tract level, you get a 58% increase over these two decades versus 17%. And a point that Scott touched on that I want to reiterate, because I think it's really important, is whether we care, and that's really shorthand, what the right measure is, whether we want to focus on a poverty rate or the number of poor, really depends on the question of interest. But I think, as he pointed out, if we're talking about service provision, resource allocation, it really is about the number of poor, because those are the people who are targeted by these programs. But poverty rates tend to be very convenient, and we often tend to cite those and think about those. But I think the size of the population and the number of poor is really important in making these distinctions. Also, just briefly, as he showed, concentrated poverty and extreme poverty do still remain largely an urban phenomenon, but we also see a fair amount of extreme poverty even outside of urban areas. I wanted to put up this one point about rural areas, and I know we'll hear more about them later today, because this is something I found actually quite striking, and that is, if you look at the rural areas, you see even poverty rates fell from 1990 to 2010, which struck me as kind of remarkable, because I think the story of whatever limited success we had in the 1990s against poverty and inequality and progress on it for low-wage workers is really one about labor markets and how robust labor markets were. But we don't really think a lot about, or there's not a lot of research attention or policy attention to employment and labor markets in rural areas. My own guess, and it really is just a guess, that if you look at some of these columns for what happened in rural areas in the 1990s, you see poverty falling. The expansion in the 1990s was truly remarkable, a sort of once-in-a-half-century phenomenon where we had such an expanded period of growth that employment rates were more robust than they had been in many decades. And this may be, I think, another way in which that expansion in the 90s was really remarkable, in that it seems perhaps to have reached even into areas without very well-developed labor markets or lots of industry. And, the labor market was so strong for this brief period of time that perhaps we saw some progress in these rural areas as well. This raises another point about when you do something and you're looking at trends or changes from 1990 to 2010, we have a very tricky problem, which is thinking about trends versus business cycles or shorter-term phenomenon, because we have in the 1990s the longest expansion ever, and in the 2000s, of course, the greatest downturn in many, many decades. And so it makes it hard to, I think, generalize from that. So the next area is of the paper, and there's a lot in this paper, very rich, is look at the safety nets. Are public and private safety nets responding differently, more or less effectively? And here, again, there's this incredibly difficult measurement issue. The public safety net programs mainly come, we have lots of data sources on these, but the way we get those data is that we look. There are many ways to do it, but the way that's done here and very common is to look at data from recipients of these transfer payments or in-kind transfers and count them, and then we look at where the recipients are, and that's how we allocate urban versus suburban. Unfortunately, it's not that standard to do that with nonprofit-based services, and that's why it's tricky. And so, as Scott makes really clear in the paper, you have to sort of rely on administrative reporting, IRS reports from these nonprofit agencies and their expenditures. The problem is that if the headquarters are in the central city, but suppose they do very effectively reach out into the suburbs, we're not going to always count that in the data. And so it's a measurement issue that's especially troubling because we're going to systematically overcount the reach in urban areas and undercount suburban. Now, I happen to agree that when you have a disparity on the order of 7 to 1, my guess is that this measurement issue is not going to explain all of that. And certainly if you talk, even in my pretty limited experience in talking with local government and social service personnel, they themselves acknowledge that it's much harder to reach their clients in outlying areas. And so I think this is a case where I just want to give a really strong compliment to this idea of combining the qualitative and quantitative work, because when those types of work happen by different authors who don't speak to one another, this is exactly the type of thing that can just be missed because you never sort of get that cross-checking. And so that's a really nice feature of this paper is the interview evidence. You get to some of these points about the struggles that are faced by those trying to provide services in this broader area. My one suggestion here, and I'll be brief, is it would be nice. I wonder if in some of our large-scale individual-based survey data, it would be possible to identify some survey questions that ask about receipt of services, interaction with nonprofit services, just to do the tabulations, because then it would at least be on par. You would be asking the recipients. It's not perfect either, but it would be a great addition to this work, I think, if there are some categories, job search assistants, something that would be a little more from the recipient side to see what those numbers look like, I think would be very interesting. The final point here that I think is one of the most fascinating parts of this paper is in the evidence from some of his interviews. There's this point where he's talking to service providers and this idea that areas that suburbs aren't well defined, but there's this great quote where someone's saying, well, we are technically a suburb, but we actually have urban poverty or urban problems, because if you look at our schools, they have all sorts of problems, so they must be urban. And so there's this breakdown between the sort of standard, the definition you'd get from a map or from population density, and a mixing of the conditions and the actual classification that, again, I think is a way in which combining quantitative and qualitative data is really important here, because otherwise the two sort of go on a different track and may not speak to each other. Okay, a few quick points about just the ideas I get from reading this paper about how it could tie into broader research on poverty, these place distinctions. One is, so, you know, we've had this sort of revolution in our classic welfare program where we've gone from cash welfare to cash welfare with a lot of conditions, with work requirements, to using the tax system and the earned income tax credit. If you think about what it means to get welfare, it's very different today than in 1990 in the sense that TANF comes with work requirements, with training requirements, and you can imagine many differences in how that happens in a city with a, perhaps well-developed public safety net offices and programs, as well as nonprofits versus in the suburbs. And so one question that comes up frequently is that, well, we still don't, in a quantitative sense, have a very good way of explaining the dramatic reduction in welfare or TANF caseloads over time. And it had me wondering whether there's any traction here to think about. We look at the poor in suburbs, what are their TANF participation rates and their work opportunities and training opportunities look like. And so it's really just a question for exploration to see if any of the trends are tied up with that. The EITC is another interesting story where, you know, much of our transfers of government programs to the poor is now happening through the tax system. The EITC, we have information on really participation, but that requires a lot. It requires knowledge of the tax system. A lot of the poor rely on tax preparation assistance, both by nonprofits and for-profits and government agencies. And so I think density of the population of poor, information provision could easily vary by place, and I think that would be interesting to understand better as we try to understand how effective the EITC is at reaching those in poverty. Two final points. One is the whole paper really begs these questions about poverty and labor markets and employment opportunities. And briefly, my thought as a labor economist is that this is really difficult because it's very hard to get high-quality data on small-area employment and unemployment conditions. We have local-area unemployment rates. They have all sorts of problems. They're based on small samples, so sometimes we use employment to population. Those aren't perfect either. But once you start to realize that many low-wage workers and many of the poor are in areas that are less densely populated, those employment measures, official employment measures, are not as high quality. And so it's a little bit of a dilemma. How do we make progress and get it right? And so I think this, again, puts a lot of importance on pushing to get better small area labor market measures, which I think is a topic that perhaps only an empirical labor economist could love. But I think this highlights how important it can be for policy and for broader research. And finally, the last point, Lisa's not cutting me off, I know I've gone on too long, is I think there's some really fascinating questions about schools by urban, suburban, rural status, and several of the quotes in the interviews got me thinking about what services does a school provide and how do those differ? Because another part of the safety net, many schools are providing essentially safety net services, nutrition, after-school care, enrichment, this cuts in various ways if you go from urban to suburban to rural districts. Urban schools may have more of a focus and a perception of need so that they're more geared to provide those, but they also may be more resource constrained, and I think understanding that better would be another part of the safety net picture by place that would be really interesting. And I will finally stop there. Thank you for a great paper.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.